You know that feeling when your day finally slows down and you just want to relax, unplug, and feel good? That's where Mood.com comes in. They're changing the game, delivering legal THC products right to your door, no shady dealers, and absolutely no medical card required, just good vibes and better sleep, shipped straight from their farm to your couch. From delicious THC gummies, smooth vape pens, to premium THC flower, Mood has it all. And everything's federally legal under the 2018 Farm Bill. Yeah, this isn't some loophole. It's the real deal. Head to Mood.com and use code FIRST20 for 20% off your first order. That's MOOD.com. Find your mood.
Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $200 into something bigger when you bet on Moneyline, spread, totals, player props.
$200 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In app only.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to a brand new episode of The Truth here on the John Rocha channel. Now, normally, The Truth is a show where we dive into some hot button topics and really get into them. And I tell you the truth, which is really my truth, on these subjects. But today we're doing something really different. And it's because we are celebrating the life and the movies and the work and the legacy of the great Robert Redford, who passed away as we're recording this yesterday at the age of 89 in his sleep. They're surrounded by family and friends in his home. And I thought, who else could I bring on to be my co-host for this conversation than my very learned friend, who is a director, writer, producer, and my co-host on the Cinephiles, a podcast that we have done for almost 10 years, breaking down a great film or a film that we love every week on the show. And that is my brother in life and the great Steve Morris. How are you, Steve? How are you feeling, brother?
I'm very good. And while the reason we're getting together is sad, I'm really happy to celebrate a person who I have adored since I was a little kid. So,
yeah.
So it's pretty, you know, pretty important guy in the film world, I think.
Yeah, for so many reasons. Steve, Robert Redford, of course, acting wise, that's where I think most people get to know him first. And then, of course, he becomes a director later on in life, wins an Academy Award for his debut directorial debut in Ordinary People, and then goes on to create the Sundance Institute and by extension the Sundance Film Festival, which launches the careers of so many phenomenal directors and actors and movies that we still talk about today, that we still consider classics. A man who was involved in many classics himself, leading to the creation of more classics to be distributed throughout the world and continue the love of this medium and the power of this medium to change people's perceptions about so many issues and so many things in the world. So, Steve, when you think about Robert Redford now and you think about the years, you know, he lived a pretty long life to 89 and went through numerous phases in his career, as I said, from, you know, young actor working with actresses like Jane Fonda and then moving into his powerhouse phases where he's working with actors like Paul Newman, doing great stuff in Butch Cassidy and Sundance Kid. Or when you look at the stuff that he does later on with All the President's Men, then The Natural into the 1980s. And then near the end of his life, doing stuff like All Is Lost, Old Man and the Gun with Sissy Spacek. And as we said, ends up directing films like he does with Ordinary People. And then Quiz Show is another really notable, exceptional film of his. So when you think about Robert Redford, man, what do you think now as he's passed on of his legacy? What stands out to you? What really comes to mind when you think of Robert Redford as an entity?
You know, what's funny is you're showing those images and we're going thinking about his life. And you know what hit me? The thing I think his legacy is his values. Like when you think about like, well, a movie star, someone who wants to be a movie star, they want fame. They want adoration. They want to be in the biggest movie there is. And that's such a driving force. And honestly, that was funny. I was just listening to a conversation. I think it was a recent Marc Maron one where they were talking about there used to be this term called selling out. Like, I don't want to sell out. And the idea of selling out is so ridiculously antiquated now because, you know, Beatles songs are being used in advertisements. Like, there is no the immediacy of being an influencer who now has brands attached to them happens right away. And so this idea of fame with being a marketable, profitable thing is how we mostly think of stardom.
Yeah.
And that's not who Robert Redford wanted to be from the very beginning of his career. I mean, for the very beginning, and even though, he's doing Barefoot in the Park, he's been TV shows, but right away we get to films like The Candidate. We get to All the President's Men really quickly. And then you look at the entirety of his career, the films that he directed and Sundance, and go, oh, he felt that his job was not to be the most famous person, not to be the person that had just the adoration of millions. He felt that he had a responsibility to use his work to do things that were good. So, like, the biggest thing that really strikes me is his values.
Well, I think in that way, he has so much in common with Paul Newman, right? Both of these gentlemen had movie star good looks, but always, like, use their platforms to fight for causes, whether overtly in front of the scenes or behind the scenes. You know, with Redford, it was environmentalism that was a very big thing, Native American rights, and of course the Sundance Institute and more. I mean, he was an executive producer on Dark Winds, which is a very strong and fantastic Native American based show that's been on AMC Plus for the last 4 years. So there is a real, like, put your money where your mouth is. And both of those guys, Redford and Newman, were these guys who did not just want to trade on their good looks. They wanted to use their platform to do good, and they wanted to make changes in the world. You know, Redford, even back in the 1970s, was trying to shuffle in documentaries to these places so that they would be shown and people could see and change their perceptions of things that are happening. So both of them, along with their stardom, had a real understanding of their power in the world and their power to affect change in the world. And I thought that to be, and I think that's an incredible legacy to leave as an artist, as a creative. And, you know, I'm not saying the creatives nowadays don't have causes. They clearly do. They show up to chair and what have you. But it seems to me that this seems to be a dying breed of the celebrity that steps forward to push for certain causes, because there's a fear of, like, well, is that going to affect your brand? As you said earlier, is that going to affect if people want to come see your stuff? Will studios be a little more paranoid? You know, I think of James Gunn recently coming out and speaking about immigration in the promotion of Superman and the backlash and the hoopla that got. And so you see that he's a legacy in that way, as you were saying earlier, Steve, that he's a guy who steps forward and understands that he's more than just an actor in the world, you know?
I think there's an important distinction between the celebrity who stands up for a cause, which I totally respect. And I believe that people, when they have a platform, if they feel strongly, they should use their platform. I'm totally fine with that.
Yeah.
There's a difference between that and someone who says, I'm going to go make this movie.
Yes.
I'm going to spend the next year of my life devoted to telling this particular kind of story. Right. You know, that's a different, there's a way more of putting your money where your mouth is and going. And it's also, I think, Redford, I mean, it's kind of obvious to say this, but I think that he saw film as a medium that could be important.
Yeah.
And that's what Sundance is. He didn't see, it's not that he was opposed to making entertaining movies. He did make some really entertaining movies, but he saw film as, like, oh, this is how we can speak important messages about the human condition and who we are, you know? Yeah.
And I also think he was drawn, and it's a great point you bring up, Steve. I think the films he was drawn to be a part of or to make were films that explored the darker edges of our humanity. Even something like The Natural, which is considered this, like, iconic Americana film on baseball, there is a commentary about the danger of celebrity, the danger of being popular, the corruption inherent in sports that still goes on today from owners on down, and accusations of match fixing or game fixing and what have you. And so you see that even recently with Pete Rose getting finally the door open to go back to go into the Hall of Fame. Rather, there was corruption around all that with the betting and what have you. So you see that even these things that he's drawn to do that would seem to be mainstream populist filmmaking or characters that are mainstream and populist, because the comeback story and all of that, there's still the darker edges of it all. That's a commentary. As you've mentioned, The Candidate, All the President's Men, Downhill Racer, even the one with him and Gene Hackman, is a commentary about sports and the desire to achieve certain things in sports and what that can do to you. You know, all of that coursing through in his direction. You're right. Quiz Show is a commentary on corruption within game shows and how that was a reflection of America, and that America was lied to so much in the 1950s and 60s of what was actually going on, or what was being presented versus what was actually going on. Or the Milagro Beanfield War, which I know wasn't a film that did well, success, that wasn't that successful at the box office, was, but was a commentary with a social point of view. And I think that's, those are essential to understanding Robert Redford, is that he was drawn to these kinds of projects, you know, and they really brought out the best of him as an actor.
I'm just thinking about how often he played characters that were put in a position of moral choice, like a character who you generally think is a good person.
Yeah,
but then they're put in a place and they don't know exactly where they're going to go. And it's interesting because we think of, like, Redford is the hero and the hero is going to do the heroic thing. But when you think about 3 Days of the Condor, it's like what he does with Faye Dunaway is really scary at a certain point.
Yep.
You know, it's like, oh, here's this guy who just seems like this nice, nerdy guy who reads a lot of books. And now he's put in this position. And what is he going to do? And the same when you're watching The Sting, there's like, yeah, he's the young guy, but we don't always know if he he's going to make the right choices. You know, like the you know, the same is true in like Jeremiah Johnson. You don't quite know. And then The Candidate, which is just an incredible. So it's always a funny choice when we're going to do one of these shows is I go, what am I going to watch? And in this case, we decided to do the show yesterday. Right. So I didn't have a lot of time. And I was going through, like, I don't need to watch The Natural. I don't need to watch The Sting. I remember those movies. We just did them a year ago. I remember them perfectly well. So the two that I chose to watch, I wanted to get to Quiz Show. I didn't make it. Okay. That was the other one I wanted to watch, was Jeremiah Johnson and The Candidate. Those are the two movies I watched yesterday because I hadn't seen them in a long time. And they're both morally ambiguous films. Yes. They both were like, this is a character who wants to do the right thing. But The Candidate is, I mean, that is a hell of a movie, which, by the way, I should say, The Candidate, the guy who edited it, Bob Estrin, is my editing teacher in film school.
He's, oh, wow.
Yeah, not a great teacher, but an unbelievably great editor.
Yeah, that's 1972. It predates Watergate. And it's a commentary on, even back in 1972, I know we think corruption in politics is like something that just happened 10 minutes ago. But like when you look at that film back in 19, it is a heartbreaking film. How you see this political neophyte who is a liberal taking on this incumbent, powerful candidate. And you see the progression of how politics ends up changing him. It's a tragedy in a lot of ways, even though it's a like it's a black comedy. But that ending is like a punch in the face.
Yep.
Of what happens sometimes to people who enter into politics with all the right instincts to do good, and how the machine is so corrupt that in order to operate within the machine, you're going to have to make, as you said, Steve, decisions, moral decisions about what you're going to do to stay in that machine and what that can lead to. And you know, what's so funny is that Redford in the 1990s, I think early 2000s, was working on a sequel to The Candidate. And I would have been amazed to see the same character all these terms later, what he would be like. Would it be like Mr. Smith Goes to Washington? Would he be the Claude Rains for the young guy who's coming up? That would have been a fascinating turn of events to see all people, for sure. Yeah,
because he's now the chair of the Ways and Means Committee, and he's entrenched I'll tell you the saddest thing about watching The Candidate last night, because it's everything you say. It's all about the real politics, cynicism, and the what is required to get to this place, to the difference between what you want to do in governance and what is required by politics. And it's a really good movie, and it's very cynical and a black comedy. And I'm looking at it, I'm going, just wistfully going, oh, for those innocent days. Because it's actually quite lovely and wholesome compared to where we are today.
It's very true. It's very true. You're absolutely right on that. But we should talk a little bit about his upbringing, because I think people have to understand, like, what he came from, where he came from, how he became the Robert Redford we come to know. And he was born in 1936 on August 18th and in Santa Monica, California. According to NPR, his working class family was the only white one on their mostly Mexican block of families. And as a kid, Redford often misbehaved at school. He recounts that he spent a lot of time at the blackboard, either writing things over and over again, figuring out a math problem, or writing a creative story on the blackboard. So he was certainly a part of that. And through his early years growing up there, because his family lived in Van Nuys and his father worked in El Segundo, which is like a really LA story, this beginnings of him, his family often traveled to Austin because they had relatives in Austin for his maternal grandfather. And that's where he developed his environmentalism and love of nature was his childhood in Texas. He ends up going to Van Nuys High School. He describes himself, quote, as a bad student who found inspiration outside the classroom in art and sports. And when he was younger, he even went through a mild case of polio when he was 11, which I didn't know about.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, doing the research, I didn't know about that either. When he graduates high school, he goes to the University of Colorado in Boulder, but he's only there for a year and a half. For those of you who are big sports fans, you know that's a university now that Deion Sanders is the coach of the football team there. But yeah, he went there for a year and a half. He was drinking heavily while he was there, and as a result, he lost his scholarship and was expelled from school. And so because of that, he went on to travel in Europe, and he lived in France and Spain and Italy. And in order to save up enough money to study painting in Europe, this is a hardscrabble kid getting in trouble in LA who is now traveling Europe after flunking out of college because of his drinking issues. He works on an oil rig to save up enough money to study painting in Europe. Now, how many people are working on an oil rig who want to become a painter in Europe? And he comes back to the U.S. after that to enroll in art school at the Pratt Institute in New York. He later studied the painting there and took classes at the American Academy of Dramatic Arts, class of 1959 in Manhattan. But the way he finds himself into acting is because he was interested in set design. And that's how he got into theater and then by consequence got into acting. And that's where we start to see the process of Robert Redford. So what an interesting path that he walked here, Steve. This is from someone who was born and then from a young age was doing plays and his family supported him. And he went into acting school, then went out and was getting roles. He's a guy who lived a myriad of different lives before he ended up an actor. And I think that's why he's such a different actor when he finally becomes one, you know?
Now I want to see the small startup business. This is 1969, 1971 company started up by Robert Redford and Harrison Ford. Harrison Ford did the carpentry. Robert Redford was doing the paint work. I'm sure we could find a young plumber around the same time. The thing listening to your story, and I know, I mean, look, I'm just going to say it exactly the way I feel it. I picture Robert Redford at 20 whatever years old showing up to paint the set at some theater company and everybody looking over going, well, who is that guy? Like, I mean, this is one of the most stunningly beautiful men in the history of Hollywood, in my opinion.
Like, look at him at such a young age. Look at that. I mean, that's incredible, incredible stuff. Yeah.
And by the way, that movie, that's Barefoot in the Park, which is where he started on Broadway. And if all you've ever seen are the classic Redford romantic lead things, go back and watch Barefoot in the Park.
Yeah.
Because he's really, first of all, I love Neil Simon. Neil Simon writes great dialogue, great comedy. He's really good at it, you know?
Yeah. And Barefoot in the Park, I mean, also Barefoot in the Park, that is another film where he is like this rigid guy who's got a way of doing things. And Jane Fonda is the one that is kind of trying to break him out of this idea of how this essentially a stick in the mud and trying to break him out of this approach to the world and how that how he navigates that within this relationship at that time, because it mirrored what was going on in our world. Right. There was the clash of the younger with the older, the silent majority, as Nixon called it, versus the young people who were rebelling against everything and the free spirit movement, you know. So you saw that he was reflecting society even in a film like that, which of course is based on the Neil Simon play, but Neil Simon writing it, but this is a character he was drawn to play. And you think about the process of what he went through, I think you're absolutely right, Steve. I think I read some tributes to him where people were quoted as saying when he walked into the cafeteria, it took your breath away seeing him in the cafeteria. So clearly people knew he was a and maybe he was one of these guys again from the beginning who knew he was attractive, probably knew he got attention all the time, but was not comfortable trading in on it until he could use it for what he wanted to use it for, which, as you said, maybe from the beginning, he knew that film or stage could be a place for him to do something more than just be a pretty face. And I think that's maybe why he stayed in the background a little bit until he was ready to come to the foreground with his acting.
I have a crazy theory. This is based on nothing, but I'm just going to throw it out there, which is so there's the nerd who can't get girls to check them out. And so they devote themselves to their guitar playing, their comedy, their coding, and that's how they find their way to success.
Yeah.
Maybe Redford's the opposite, which is that getting girls to pay attention to him was no problem whatsoever. He wasn't interested in it. So he was interested in, I want to do this other stuff that's more important. I mean, I probably told this story as many times as any story in the Cinephiles, but I still love, so Redford, when he did Barefoot in the Park on Broadway, was directed by Mike Nichols. So when Mike Nichols is going to cast The Graduate, he's looking at the character, and the character description of Benjamin is a blonde-haired, blue-eyed California surfer type.
Right.
So the first person he thinks of is Robert Redford to play Benjamin, because that's how it's written in the book. And he's talking to Redford, and he's pretty much decided to cast him, and says, so Bobby, tell me, have you ever not scored with a girl? And Redford turns to Mike Nichols and says, what do you mean not scored? And it was that moment that he realized that Robert Redford could not play this part.
Yeah, you know, in doing research for him, there were articles that stated that he also felt that the part would have typecast him, and he didn't want to be typecast at that time as well. So maybe it was like a mutual understanding that it wasn't the right situation for him, because he also turned down the role in the George Segal role in What Happened to Virginia Woolf.
Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf?
Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf? I got Who's Coming to Dinner locked in with something else. So yes, Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf?
A good combo, is we're somehow combining Guess Who's Coming to Dinner with Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf. We got Spencer Tracy, Katherine Hepburn, Elizabeth Taylor, Richard Burton, Sidney Poitier. This is going to be a hell of a show.
I'm down. Steve, we are in the height of summer right now, and fruit is all over the place to enjoy at the farmer's market and in other places there. And, you know, it can be hard to eat healthy without feeling like you're giving up flavor or fun, because you have so many restrictions, so many requirements on this kind of stuff. But Washington Red Raspberries is something you and I have been talking about. They're a clean, simple, and seriously delicious way to add more nutrition to your day. What has been your experience with these Washington Red Raspberries?
Well, if you think it's hard to convince yourself to eat healthy during these hot summer months, imagine trying to convince a 14-year-old who really, really likes a whole bunch of stuff that don't include fruit and vegetables to eat healthy. Well, our new program for my son Jackson has been a smoothie a day every single day. Wow. And the main ingredient of those smoothies has been the incredible red raspberries. Not only are they sweet and delicious, but that incredible taste allows me to maybe also include a couple of vegetables or a little protein or some other healthy stuff that my son needs. So these Washington Red Raspberries have been an absolute godsend to my family.
Yeah, and the frozen Washington Red Raspberries, Steve, are one of the best kept secrets in the freezer aisle. They're naturally low in sugar, high in fiber, and support gut health, blood sugar balance, and overall wellness, which I think is good for anybody, whether they're a 14-year-old kid or old fogey like you and I. So if you all want to discover new ways to use American frozen red raspberries and get more details of where you can grab a bag of these delicious berries, go to redraz.org. That's redraz.org. You'll find recipes, health tips, retail locations, and everything you need to make frozen Washington red raspberries a regular part of your routine.
Look for product of the U.S. on the bag.
Look, if you're still buying weed from some guy named Trevor in a parking lot, you're doing it wrong. Mood.com delivers legal THC products straight to your door. Gummies, vapes, flower, the good stuff. No sketchy DMs, no med card. Just add to cart, check out, and boom, it's at your doorstep. It's legal in all 50 states, thanks to the Farm Bill, and Mood's products actually work. Seriously, this isn't gas station garbage. It's small batch, lab-tested, real results. Go to Mood.com, use code FIRST20 for 20% off, and never run dry again. That's Mood.com. Go get lit, legally.
Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $200 into something bigger when you bet on Moneyline, spread, totals, player props.
$200 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In app only.
But yeah, so you see that, and so he has that. He opens the door into acting, and he gets trained at the American Academy of Dramatic Arts, as I said, and as Steve alluded to, his big Broadway show was Barefoot in the Park, but he made his Broadway debut in a small role in Tall Story in 1959. Then Parts in the Highest Tree in 1959, Sunday in New York, which is, so those of you who hold up to remember the classic play that was in 1961. And yes, Barefoot in the Park comes in 1963. He made his screen debut, ironically, with an adaptation of Tall Story. So both Tall Story and Barefoot in the Park, leading to seminal moments in his life as an actor, both on stage and on screen. He also earned an Emmy nomination as Best Supporting Actor for his performance in The Voice of Charlie Pont in 1962. He did a lot of TV before he got onto the stage and onto the screen. He was in Alfred Hitchcock Presents, The Twilight Zone, Naked City, Maverick, The Untouchables, The Americans, Perry Mason, Route 66, Dr. Kildare, The Twilight Zone, The Virginian, Tate, and Playhouse 90, among other shows as well. So, you know, this is the thing sometimes we forget. Oh, he showed up on screen, but like there's all this work of him working on these TV shows, working on his craft, building up his resume, figuring out what he wants to do as an actor. Paul Newman has this on his resume as well. And for me, when I get onto Pluto TV sometimes and watch the old shows, it's so amazing to see these actors who go on to become massive stars involved in these smaller parts on these shows. Same thing happens as I'm a massive Law & Order fan when I see Pedro Pascal or Idris Elba or, you know, a number of other actors that are involved in as small parts in Law & Order, Adam Driver, who go on to become these massive stars. So you see this with Robert Redford that I think is fascinating, Steve. He did all this TV work as well before he got really established on screen.
That you took the words right out of my mouth. That I was going to say is like this idea today is, well, obviously, if you're an actor who lives in New York, you will be on a CSI and one of these and one of those.
Right. Yeah.
You're just going to. And at that time, you were going to be on a Playhouse 90 and an Outer Limits and a Route 66. And, you know, that's the way you made your bones.
Yeah.
I mean, like the interesting thing to me is the navigation between some Broadway acting in a comedy and then all this TV work to when you get to Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, where he is just because we did it last year. We obviously went and dip, and it was great because you led this one. So you got to, as the outlaw, lead us through this Western, which was an absolute ball. And to just think about, you know, Redford, who is a new movie star, brand new movie star, is going toe to toe with one of the biggest movie stars of all time, and it is seamless. They are 100% equals, and it feels as if they've been just on screen together. It's crazy to me that we don't have the Newman Redford thing. It's only a couple movies, you know.
Yeah, yeah. Only a couple that's of it. Movies, but I think that's what makes it magic. You know, I mean, the Pacino De Niro thing has already outstayed its welcome. There are quite a few people who stay, Gene Wilder and Richard Pryor, doing See No Evil, Hear No Evil. There's always that chance that you do that one film too many in the pairing that undercuts the power, you know? And I think the fact that we have The Sting and Butch Cassidy and Sundance Kid, two exceptional films, two iconic films, and them at the top of their game in their prime, feeding off each other. You know, Pauline Kael said it was great to see him with an actress finally after flirting with Paul Newman for so long. You know, you see these things that people felt that there was a genuine, not a physical romance, but a romance, a bromance, as people might say now, between these two guys. And if you had done that one extra movie that didn't quite get there, I think it would have undercut it a little bit. So like James Dean, like we can still love James Dean's work because he did those four films and then tragically died because he didn't do like The Island of Dr. Moreau 3 decades later, like Brando. Like he stays in our mind in a certain way. And I think this pairing stays as a magical pairing, or for Steve and I, like the Beatles, like, Yes, it right. would have been great to see the Beatles get together in the 70s or 80s or 90s, but nothing says they would have made the same music, the same kind of music that they did in the 60s, you know? And so that you have that element to it, which I thoroughly enjoy. But let's get into it.
I was just going to say, there's something satisfying about having the box set. Like, this is right. it. This is the complete collection of that thing. Yes. There are no dangle, you know, there's no Muhammad Ali fighting Larry Holmes to worry about.
Oh,
you know,
yeah.
like there's the, yeah. this is it. This is where it is great. It is perfect. And enjoy it, you know?
Yeah. There's no Marvel's phases 4 and 5. No, I'm just joking. I'm just joking. Don't get mad at me. Don't get mad at me. But let's move on to the 70s. Let's move on. Well, actually, do you want to say anything about Barefoot in Park? Do you want to say anything about these earlier movies? Like, did you grow up on these? Did your parents show you these? Like, what was your experience with the early Redford stuff? Or did you
so Barefoot in the Park? Yeah, Barefoot in the Park I discovered later. I think my first Redford, I'm not really sure because mm-hmm. he was ubiquitous, but I have no memory of not knowing Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid.
Oh, wow.
You know, so that's okay. really where it starts. So it's much later on, probably yeah. when I was in college, that right. I saw Barefoot in the Park. And I was like, well, who is this young, funny, uptight, you know, New York guy? Like, it's just a totally, totally different thing. But no, yeah. it's the 70s Redford that is like the formative stuff yeah. for me.
Well, where do you want to start? Do you want to start with Butch Cassidy's Sundance Kid? Do you want to start here and explore this relationship, explore his work in this movie? I mean, this is the one that Paul Newman and the director had to convince the studio to cast Robert Redford in this role, because according to one recollection, the studio executives said that he was too generic, too bland to play the role, which I find to be just insane, because the chemistry and what you got from this guy was amazing.
Well, this is why I'm not going to say executives don't know anything. There are plenty of brilliant executives out there who are awesome. Sure. But, you sure. know, the William Goldman quote, "Nobody knows anything," is a pretty good one in terms. I mean, you can hear all sorts of stories, you know, like it pops up in my feed all the time. Matt Damon turning down Avatar. You yeah. know what I mean? Like yeah. all sorts of smart people miss the cool thing.
Yeah,
I think the most brilliant thing for me about Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid is the choice in casting, because in my memory of it is we did this a year ago.
Yeah.
But initially they were like, well, Paul Newman should play Butch or yes. should play Sundance that because that's the cooler character. And Newman wanted to not be cool. Like yeah. that was like the comedy. It's Newman putting himself in that position of being really smart and funny and goofy and continuing to make mistakes and continuing to be frustrated. Yeah. And Sundance playing the straight man, essentially. Yeah. Like the calm thing, it's that energy. And in particular, therefore, when Sundance loses it, when they're in the garden spot of Bolivia and he just goes off. And to me, I know I said it when we did it, it's like you can hear the Neil Simon training. You can yeah. hear it's a comedic rant. And getting to that point is just perfect with the two of them.
It's such a confident performance, you know. And again, this is a guy who's still making his bones. They had to fight for him to be in this movie. I mean, I liken this to Pacino in The Godfather. They had to fight to yeah. put Pacino in The Godfather. And they both deliver these confident, iconic, powerful performances, you know. And you can be deluded into seeing the chemistry, and it's a fun movie. But there are moments where you see that kid who got in trouble as a young man, that kid who had to go to Europe because he flunked out of school because he was drinking and out. You know, became too much of a drunk to stay in school. You see that Redford had this inner anger, this inner rage that could come out in certain moments. And certainly in the ways that he treats Catherine Ross in certain moments, you see that come through. Or the when he explodes at Butch about not being able to swim, you know, not knowing how to swim. These moments of rage from him that I think are great layers to the character that he builds in the movie, you know. So by the end, we're so in love with them because we've seen all of them as who they are in these various situations, that we feel that moment when they run out. And very smartly, they don't show them getting, like, it isn't a Sam Peckinpah ending of The Wild Bunch. We don't need to see it because they've done so much to establish them that we have it in our mind. We get to keep them as these... I don't know, as these heroes in our minds without seeing them cut up in the way they are. But there's so much throughout the movie that he's just so powerful as an actor, man. And you feel for him. Even when you see him in these bad moments, you still feel sympathy for him because you know he's just a frustrated guy who's trying to just get his head above water And aren't so many of us like that in life? Well, we don't turn to crime, but so many of us who try to keep our head above water, you know?
You know, what just occurred to me is how many movies, how many of Robert Redford movies, not that he had control of these, end with an ambiguous moment, with a sudden moment. So obviously Butch and Sundance, the ending is like one of the most iconic endings in all of film. But I just watched The Candidate, and The Candidate definitely has an ending that's just sort of, okay, it's what do we do now? You know, the end of All the President's Men is a very like, here's, okay. You know, like he's, and you think about too, like the ending of Ordinary People, you know, I would say too, the ending of Quiz Show doesn't just go like, and here's what's good and here's what's bad. He like goes, takes you through a thing and goes, all right, there you go. Deal with that.
And then the family now has to deal with this, and we don't see what happens to the family afterwards, but now we know the family is forever changed because of what happened.
Yeah.
I agree. Even the ending of Downhill Racer, that exchange, I don't know if you've seen it, but the exchange
he has, a long time ago, I have almost no memory of it. Yeah.
The exchange he has with the other racer, I think he's German at the end, because it's been a while since I've seen it. There's something in his eyes before he's carried off in victory. Like there's something else that's there. As you say, ambiguous ending. It's not spoken, but there's something else, and it's up to the audience to decide what was in his eyes in that moment, you know? And I appreciate that. Again, it's just he's drawn to these kinds of roles, or he brings that interpretation of these kinds of roles that keep you in that place. And after I mentioned Downhill Racer, if you guys haven't seen that, I think it's a Criterion. You guys can watch that. I highly recommend it. The Hot Rock, a lot of people like The Hot Rock as a fun.
I've never seen it. Yeah,
fun heist film with him and George Segal. Ron Liebman, one of the great character actors who passed away as well. And we did his movie in Zorro the Gay Blade as the Alcalde. And Charlotte Ray is in this one. Moses Gunn is in this one. So I highly recommend it as a heist film if you guys haven't seen that one as well.
Now, okay, I think I have seen it. Yeah, okay. I think I have. You know those movies where it's like Sunday afternoon and it's like you're switching channels?
Perfect
movie. There's another one because you said George Segal, and I just all these images of him like Fun with Dick and Jane. Or there's something like The Killing of the Great French. Who's killing the French chefs of Europe?
Yes.
I think I have seen The Hot Rock. I have like images in it in my head, but I'm not 100%.
I mean, heist films were big in the 70s. We know that, right? All the way up until Thief and the Michael Mann film in 1980. But then he moves on to do Jeremiah Johnson. As you said, Steve, this is yet another character here. He's a soldier who is disillusioned with society. So he goes out into the wilderness to kind of reconnect with America, reconnect with himself, reconnect with nature, and maybe find his path. As you were saying, these characters who are kind of lost or disconnected and need to find their way back. This is all throughout Jeremiah Johnson. We haven't done this one yet on the Cinephiles. I can't wait till we do it. But what are your thoughts on this? One of my favorite Westerns. It's an unusual Western in many ways.
This is one I chose to rewatch last night, because... It has, one of the great memes of all. It's a weird thing that movies are now famous because they contain a famous meme. It's just a strange, strange world that we live in. But I wanted to watch it because it was one that I didn't remember well and had seen a lot. And I was like, okay, let's check. And I'll tell you the experience I had watching it, which is, and I've really only had this experience twice. And the other one, strangely enough, do you remember Spirit Stallion of the Cimarron?
Of course. Yes.
I remember the experience I had watching that movie was just this is the world before humans came along. The wide open spaces of our world that was the normal world a couple hundred years ago. And I think Jeremiah Johnson, more than any other movie I can think of, has the feeling of, this is what it's like to be alone. This is what it's like to be far away from other humans, or this is the only other human you've seen. At one point he says, you're the first human I've seen in 2 months.
Yeah.
You know, like that. So that is really, and the other thing that's really cool, because I think in general, Redford's obviously a very intelligent dude and tends to play very intelligent dudes.
Yeah.
Jeremiah Johnson, not a variant. I mean, it's not that he's dumb, but he's sort of muddling through this world and through these impossible situations. It's good. I mean, it's like what I was thinking as we're having this conversation of what films would I recommend to someone who's never seen Redford and doesn't really know him, and Jeremiah Johnson wouldn't be that high on the list. But if you're a big Redford fan and haven't seen Jeremiah Johnson yet, then you need to go check that out.
Yeah. I thought their analysis, the Rolling Stone did a fantastic article on the 20 best Robert Redford films. If you want to dive into Robert Redford, Jeremiah was on that list. And one of the things they said, which I hadn't even put together in my mind, was this was like a precursor for what he does in All Is Lost, which is one of his most recent films.
Oh, sure.
Right. Because All Is Lost, he says maybe six words in the whole movie. J.C. Chandor, I think, directed that one. And he just is there with him, man versus nature in the boat. How do I live? How do I survive? What happens if I don't? And Jeremiah is kind of in that way as well. He is, the war happens and he wants to go off and figure out where he fits now. And reconnecting with the land is his attempt to try to figure out. It's almost like a Theodore Roosevelt Western, right? Because TR did that after his mom and his wife died on the same night. He went off to go live in the West, even though he was a congressman currently in New York at the time. He went off to live in the West to deal with his grief and his trauma, to reconnect with America. And I think this is also, you know, showing his proclivity for environmentalism, because I think nature is shown as a beautiful thing, a scary thing at times as well, but a beautiful thing to experience. And it's crazy to think that Eastwood was the original choice and he turned it down, and they turned to Redford to do it. Because I mean, an Eastwood Jeremiah Johnson would be fascinating as well. So I think Redford did an incredible job with that one, for not, you know, for only having done a different kind of Western in Butch Cassidy to jump into that one.
I wonder if Eastwood could have had the growth that, because Jeremiah Johnson, when he shows up, he's not ready. Like, he needs to find, I think it's Uncle Jesse from the, you know, from the Dukes of Hazzard, in order to learn kind of the ropes.
Yeah.
And I don't know that Eastwood would be as good at that. That's a good point.
Well, we do see the growth in Unforgiven, but you might be right. You might, maybe he wasn't there at the time to deliver that kind of growth like Redford was. But well, you know, it's a great what if for sure. We talked about The Candidate already. Anything more you want to add about The Candidate as we move through his movies? Anything more you want to say about that? Okay.
Your check, your cooperative. As a farmer-owned lender, Farm Credit Mid-America shares the success of the cooperative with our customers, which is why we've returned more than $1.5 billion back to our customer owners over the last 9 years. It's proof being a part of our cooperative pays. Patronage is an annual decision made by the board of directors to return earnings to eligible customers. To learn more about patronage and eligibility, visit fcma.com/patronage.
Have you seen The Way We Were? This is my mother's favorite Robert Redford. Oh my God. Can we talk about that one?
I mean, I think you should talk about it. Like, have I seen it? Yes, I've seen it. And it's good. It is a lovely romantic thing. I don't think I've watched it since I was 14, and I certainly didn't rush back to watch it, but it's a lot of mom's favorite movies. So what's your experience with it?
First of all, my experience is my mom making me watch it with her. This is probably the first Robert Redford movie I ever watched, but The Natural was the first one that I remember like putting the hook in me. Right. But The Way We Were is because my mom used to sing the song all the time. She's a big Barbara Streisand fan, my mom. And so I was inundated with Barbara Streisand music growing up for sure. But this was a fascinating. And you know, it's Barbara Streisand also at her peak. She is in her power here as this New York person versus, you know, the Santa Monica person and Robert Redford, how they make this relationship work, the ins and outs, the back and forths. And they on paper, you wouldn't put these two together. Yet when you watch them on screen, they truly have an amazing chemistry. Is the film one that I personally go back and watch all the time? No, but I know that there's a lot of people who do and who love the magic of this movie because of the chemistry between Robert Redford and Barbara Streisand. And you talk about this too, that I think is really important to note, is like, as good as he was with his male co-stars, it's not always true that those men can branch out and be just as powerful in their chemistry with female co-stars, especially female co-stars who are in their prime and in their power, like Jane Fonda, Barbara Streisand. These aren't wallflowers, right? And he is going toe-to-toe with them, and there's an equality in their relationships that come through when you see them on screen. And it's a male actor who's not caught up in the whole I need to be front and center, who can work with women like that and accept the equality of the situation rather than trying to come out ahead. And Faye, you throw in Faye Dunaway as well in 3 Days of the Condor. Like, he rolls with these really powerful women throughout his movies. And I think that speaks volumes about how he is not intimidated by that stuff and welcomes the challenge, you know?
Oh, absolutely. And I think, you know, the thing about Robert Redford, isn't shy. He doesn't crack. He's not insecure. Maybe he I'm sure he has insecurities inside. I'm sure sometimes he wakes up and goes, nobody likes me. You know, everybody has those feelings, but it certainly doesn't show on screen. And I think the thing that you're pointing out in terms of actors who have a tough time going up against a powerful actress is it's that insecurity, which Robert Redford doesn't have. Right. He's just, and the thing too, he frequently would rather tear himself down a little bit.
Yes.
I mean, like a movie that I watched over and over again. And it's so, this is the thing people don't understand today is it's not that I chose to watch this movie over and over again. It's that this movie was on.
Yeah.
And so you're switching channels. If I saw The Electric Horseman, I watched The Electric Horseman. Yes. I watched it many, many, many times. And him and Jane Fonda go, and of course, in that case, he is playing the person that has all the information. You know what I mean?
Yes.
But like that, the chemistry, and I don't know, I haven't watched it in a long time. I'm not going to say I think it's a great movie, but their chemistry is great together. And that's Sidney Pollack as well, right?
Right. Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah.
And once again, it's a commentary film, isn't it? Because he's a guy of lower financial means and lower status in society who steals this horse from this rich guy. And as an act of rebellion with lights on and all of that, draws attention to himself to ride it down the center of the, I think it's Times Square that he rides down the center of.
That's it's the Vegas casino.
Oh, Vegas casino. Right. He does it on purpose to get the attention there. And so again, a role he's drawn to that has darker edges to it because of the commentary that it's making, you know? And yeah, I agree. Him and Jane Fonda in that is fantastic as well. Because it's that classic, you know, a reporter falling in love with her subject type of thing. But it works so well because those two have such great chemistry throughout that movie. Go back to the Sting. We go to the Sting after the way we were. It's 1973. Thoughts on the Sting? Anything more that we haven't said already here on the show or on our breakdown on the Cinephiles, which was, I think, a three-parter, the Sting. So
the Sting's okay. It's no big deal. But you know what we should say? Actually, what we really should say is, as you know, this is on the John Rocha channel, but we're also going to be re-releasing almost all of our Robert Redford films on the Cinephiles. Yes. And that means we're going to be re-releasing 3 Days of the Condor, Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, The Sting, The Natural, as well as Ordinary People and All the President's Men.
Yeah.
So all of those. So this is going to be a whole week. And some of these are a 2-hour episode, but some of the later ones, these are going to be 4 or 5 hour long deep dives that you're going to get all coming every single day coming up this week.
Yeah. Yeah. And you can download the Cinephiles podcast wherever you download podcasts. Or you can, if you're a YouTube person, you can listen to them on YouTube. You won't see our faces unless we're doing the live shows, but you can listen to our episodes on our YouTube channel as well. Good plug there, Steve. Absolutely agree with you for doing that at this point in the show. But yeah, The Sting, I think is an amazing performance. It's one that I don't watch all the time. So getting to do it with you, I thought was such a fun time. And if my friend listened to our show, loved our show, and he sent me the 4K of The Sting because it's one of his favorite movies, and he never understood why I didn't love it as much as he did, because we traded stories about films all through the 90s and 2000s. So he sent it to me as a thank you for finally agreeing how great the film was when we watched it. So yeah, fantastic performance there from Robert Redford as well. Then you get into The Great Gatsby, The Great Waldo Pepper. Those are interesting films to watch. I don't think his Gatsby is the best interpretation. I don't think DiCaprio's is either. I don't think we've seen a really good interpretation of Great Gatsby yet, but I think he does a good job in that. Waldo Pepper is one of those ones, as you mentioned earlier, Steve, when you're of a certain age growing up at a certain time, there are certain films that are constantly on your local channel. And growing up in Virginia, WWDC5 showed The Great Waldo Pepper all the time on Saturday afternoons. It was almost like the TBS for that time. What do you remember about Waldo Pepper or Great Gatsby? Anything there to say on him?
So I don't care. This is such a horrible admission to make. Yeah. I've read The Great Gatsby many times. I read it in high school. I read it sometime in college. I read it again recently, maybe 3 years ago. Of all the great books, I don't love The Great Gatsby. I just, I'm really sorry. And I listen to people who I respect, who are some of the great thinkers, and they're like, this is the greatest book of American literature. I've listened to lectures on The Great Gatsby. I just don't love it. And so, and I didn't love the Redford one, and I don't love the DiCaprio one. And so I don't know. Yeah. Waldo Pepper, again, a movie that is ambiguous and difficult. You know, like, it is not, there are parts of it that are very fun.
Yeah.
But it's a dark, messed up, weird movie. It's another one I thought about rewatching because I haven't seen in a while. And another one where I go, look, if you've done all the big Redford ones, go check out The Great Waldo Pepper. See what you think of that.
100% agree with you, man. 100% agree with you. You gotta be completist on this stuff because he rarely does a bad movie. He always delivers a great performance, even in a bad movie. Now, we get to the later films and you can argue quality, but like, he's bringing it during this time here in the 1970s. Then we get into 3 Days of the Condor. We've touched on that as well, Steve. This is a powerhouse of a performance. And, you know, you could even make this movie now. Like, this is topical now. A guy who's part of an intelligence agency, something... A certain operation happens, people are killed, and he's got the information to out what's really going on here, and has to rely on his wits and rely on the help of Faye Dunaway in order to achieve what he needs to achieve. And we see, like, I think we see the full gamut of Robert Redford as an actor. We see him charming, we see him roguish, we also see him angry, we see that streak of his that strong streak of his when he gets into his angry moments. And then we see him in the end, you know, becoming the hero that turns things around because of his obstinate belief that there's a difference between good and evil, you know?
Well, maybe turns things around again. Oh, it's another ambiguous ending. We don't quite know where that goes. I agree with you. True. I think whatever your politics are, there have been times in the last 7 years that you did not trust the government.
Yeah.
And you worried about what would happen if the government was weaponized against us, and what would you do? And that is 3 Days of the Condor. The great thing about it, it's not that 3 Days of the Condor, you go 100% these people are evil. It's that you don't know. It's that you know some things of the things that are going on, but you don't know all of them. And so you never are 100% sure on who you can trust or what. Yeah. Great movie. And it was a great conversation we had with our guest, Steve Jones.
Yes, absolutely, on that movie. And let's move on to the big movie, man. All the President's Men. This is, I feel like, you know, in an actor's career, there are films that they're leading to. And this is one that they absolutely led to. And this is one that Robert Redford, as you said in our breakdown, Steve, was instrumental in making this happen, getting the rights to the book, wanting to do this thing. And in the end, he had all the right instincts because it's an incredible film, an incredible performance. Yes, Dustin Hoffman has the more showier performance, as Dustin Hoffman is as an actor. But Redford's quiet movement through all of this as they're putting these pieces together, as a guy who can't believe what's happening, and then as more of it comes in, is just shocked at how much of this is being covered up. It's a great performance, man.
So this is really, it just proves the thing we've been talking about this whole time. This is Redford at the peak of his power.
Yeah.
And what does he choose to do at the peak of his power, but go right into the most controversial political event of their times? And what's really, and I remember it from when we had our discussion with Karen, my ex, who's a great guest on the show, and we talked about that, is I remember that it's not just that he's instrumental in getting the movie made. He's instrumental in telling the story of Watergate because the book hasn't come out yet.
Right.
He's the one that convinces Woodward and Bernstein to tell the story from their perspective. Yeah. They were going to tell the whole story from the perspective of the Watergate break-in. That's where reporters are not supposed to be characters in their own story. It's Robert Redford that convinces them to tell the story that way. And this is why it's like, he's not just an important figure in film history. Yeah. He's an important figure in history. And the tenaciousness of what they tried to do with that movie, the accuracy. Yeah. I mean, that's an intense film. And people don't understand it. It is literally being made while these events are happening. You know?
That's crazy. It's so crazy how topical and the timing of that film and what was going on. So excellent point, Steve. After All the President's Men, and that's I mean, if I'm going to tell you to start anywhere with Robert Redford, if you're not going to go Butch Cassidy and The Sting, maybe you're not into heist or westerns, All the President's Men, man, that's totally a great entry point into Robert Redford. But then he does a small part in A Bridge Too Far, which everyone was in that damn movie. Then he does The Electric Horseman, as we spoke about just a few minutes ago. But now we go into the 80s, which I think is a bit more where we start to see a little bit more of the spottiness and decision making and the choices he makes for the films that he's in. I remember seeing Brubaker as a young man. That one doesn't get enough credit as a damn good Robert Redford movie. He's a warden who it's just essentially undercover boss before there was undercover boss. He's a warden who masquerades as a prisoner in order to fix the prison system. And for those of you who don't remember, in the 1970s, that was a massive, massive deal. It doesn't mean that prison reform isn't still talked about nowadays, but in the 1970s, it was very controversial that all these practices were being revealed about how horribly prisoners were being treated in these prisons. And so this film, again, Steve, a darker film, a topical film exploring an issue that had gotten a lot of attention over the last few years in the 1970s before this film came out in 1980.
It freaked me out as a kid. I think I saw it. I think I saw it relatively young. I probably saw it on Showtime in 1980 or 81. And it was intense, you know? Like, I don't think I've seen it probably in 25 years. So I don't have a strong memory of it, except that it was really intense.
Yeah. Him and Yaphet Kotto have such an interesting relationship throughout the whole movie. And you have a young Morgan Freeman in this film as well. A young Jane Alexander, who, of course, I love from Great White Hope. A young David Keith. Our friend Murray Hamilton from Jaws is in this movie.
Oh, there you go.
So a lot of great actors. But yeah, exploring the corruption within the penal system. And it is a depressing film. You know, this isn't Birdman of Alcatraz. This isn't Escape from Alcatraz. This is an actual honest exploration of how prisoners are being treated and how much people didn't want to listen to their complaints because they're prisoners. They're no longer human to a lot of society, you know, and I thought that was an incredible job he did in that film as well. Now we move in from Brubaker into our 3 years later. This is 4 years later. He takes a break for a long time. And what a way to come back, brother. He comes back with The Natural in 1984. One of my favorite episodes, breaking down this movie with you recently and revisiting this movie. I'll never need an excuse to do it. It is my number one Robert Redford film. What are your thoughts about his performance now as we look back on it today?
Well, I said how much I loved it, and it was my favorite baseball movie and among my favorite sports movies when we did it the first time. I said the same thing when we did it the second time. I adore this movie. This is Americana comfort film food. It is so beautiful. It's lyrical and pastoral, and Robert Redford timed it so perfectly with his age, because if he did this 6 months later, he's too old. He's right at the edge where he could pull this off. And it gives me all the feels. It has the incredible score, incredible cinematography, great supporting cast with Glenn Close and Wilford Brimley. It's just, and it is the apotheosis of the baseball movie. It is the perfection. It is this is exactly why baseball is America's pastime, and why, in my opinion, along with boxing, it is the two greatest sports to make films about.
Yeah, no, agree with you 100%. And, you know, sometimes I think people disregarded his acting because he was only nominated, I think, once for an Oscar. He won numerous Golden Globes. He won awards from other places. He did get an honorary Academy Award, but he was rarely nominated or recognized by the main body, the Academy, there for his work. And you look at his transition in this film. You look at his journey in this. He is so believable as this young kid, wide-eyed, idealistic. And yes, they're shooting him in soft lighting. They're making him look young. But it's believable. You're in it. You're buying the innocence of him. And so that and then the scene with him and Joe Don Baker, who's playing the whammer, and when he strikes him out, you see that there's this youthful excitement of what's to come. And that's so important to make us believe in that, because when that scene with Barbara Hershey happens and we see this older guy come through the darkness into the dugout, back into baseball, he's haggard. He's lived his years. There's more wear and tear on him. There's a real pain of having carried the guilt of what happened that day and how it's changed him as a person. And so we go on a second journey of him coming back to that kid And it's a great performance from him throughout, as he's playing off of the people who are trying to help him and the people who are beholden to him, like the team, and the people who are trying to destroy him. You know, you mentioned great act Robert Prosky, Darren McGavin. I mean, it's incredible to watch him go toe-to-toe with each of these actors who get nice fleshed out portrayals by the actors themselves, you know? So it's great, great stuff there in The Natural. From The Natural, we move on to Out of Africa. I still have not seen this one, Steve. It's still a blind spot on my Robert Redford resume. What are your thoughts on Out of Africa? I don't even have a picture for it.
It was always one of Karen's favorite films. I haven't seen it in a really long time. It's good. Yeah. It's totally, yeah. It
won the best picture.
It did. My guess is it's probably pretty dated. You know, there's certain movies that win best picture where you don't go, this is not a bad film. You know, like you don't like, it's not an offense that it wins best picture, but just over the years you start to go, oh, there were more interesting movies going on. But like Meryl Streep. Color Purple, I think, is a much more interesting movie. Meryl Streep is great. Redford's great. Like, it's beautifully filmed. It's good.
Yeah. Then we go into some interesting choices. He does Legal Eagles, which I think is a interesting choice. Him and Deborah Winger, Daryl Hannah is this supposed pyromaniac. And the only thing I remember about this movie is the song from Robert Redford, Love Touch. And then the pairing of Deborah Winger and Robert Redford. Do you have any memories of Legal Eagles?
No, I really don't. I know that I've seen it, but I really have no memory of it at all.
Yeah, it's such an odd choice. And then Havana comes in, which I think he had a personal interest in trying to talk about what was going on there in Cuba at the time. Again, a connection to his social con, but it didn't come off as a great film. I think him and Lena Olin have nice chemistry in the movie, but it just isn't, you know, one of those ones that you go back and need to watch, in my opinion.
I remember going to see this one, and I was a huge Redford fan at this point. Like at this point, I really was, you know, a movie person, and being so excited and going to see it in the theater. And you know, when you walk out of a movie and you're trying to kind of convince yourself that the movie was better than it was, like that was my experience with Havana. No, it was good. It was good. Your voice goes up an octave and a half, you know.
And then we move on to Sneakers, which I think was a really fun film. A lot of great actors involved in Sneakers, and this is, people don't seem to remember how great this was, but when you're reminded of it, you just have a smile on your face because it's a fantastic film. And he doesn't have to carry the weight of the movie, right? Not like Havana, who he had to be the lead. This film, there's so many good actors bouncing off Robert Redford that he doesn't have to carry the load. I enjoyed it. What about you, man? Have you seen this one in a while?
Love it. Love Sneakers. Yeah. Totally, totally love it. And this is exactly the kind of movie that really just doesn't get made, which is a mid-budget, star-studded, fun film. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like that we're, and by the way, still about important themes of privacy and security and all of that stuff. And yes, the ensemble in this movie is spectacular, and every one of them is great.
And and he's moved into that place where, like, he has to reckon with his sins of the past, right? He's now moved into this area as an actor where he's no longer going against the system and fighting against the system. Now he's the guy who has made mistakes in the past, and now the past has caught up to him. How does he deal with that, you know? And I like that element of it. It is a fun film for sure, but there is that element of it to it. But, I mean, listen to the cast. Ben Kingsley, Mary McDonnell, who recently has just cast the Vision series, River Phoenix, Sidney Poitier, David Strathairn, Dan Aykroyd are all part of this movie here. So it's a fun one. If you guys haven't seen Sneakers, highly recommend it as a fun, like, Saturday afternoon movie that you can watch when you get a chance to watch it. And then from Sneakers, you move on to Indecent Proposal. Steve, this was a massive film. I think this was his highest grossing film ever, Indecent Proposal. I think it made like $350 million back then, which I think is $600 million nowadays, something like that. But amazing, this film, and really controversial. Is it a feminist film or is it not a feminist film? And for those of you who don't know, this is a film where Robert Redford plays this millionaire, I think, who offers to have a night with Demi Moore, and she's married to Woody Harrelson, and she makes the decision to do it because they need the money because of, I think,
for $1 million.
For $1 million. I think Woody's gambling or whatever caused them to be in financial debt. So she agrees to do it. So it's a more serious take on Honeymoon in Vegas in a way. So what are your thoughts on Indecent Proposal?
It's so funny because this was so the zeitgeist of this moment of because this was sexy and scandalous. And you have this hot young actress and this older, hot, sexy actress and money and moral questions. And there was so much talk about this movie before it came out and debates on the talk shows about would you do it, would you not do it, and how much money and all this stuff. And then the movie comes out and it's, you know, whatever. Such a whatever film. I didn't think much of this movie at all.
Oh, damn, I liked this movie. It hit me at the right time. As you said, the sexiness of it all, the conflict within it, directed by Adrian Lin, who did Fatal Attraction, which I recently watched again, and just that film is so good. But it leaves you with a lot of questions by the end. So, I mean, this may have been what attracted him to the movie, you know, after having done Sneakers, where here's a film that like actually asks some tough questions of the audience. And, you know, he has that moment where that's very reminiscent of Bernstein and Citizen Kane, where he talks about this young woman that he remembers in his life and never made the move or never got a chance to talk to her, and thinks that she could have changed his life. So you see him as this rich guy who, for all his money and all his stuff and all his power or whatever, he's still painfully lonely, and he is not the success that you think he is. So a little bit of exposing what's really going on behind the scenes with something like that. Then you go into Up Close and Personal, The Horse Whisperer, Last Castle, Spy Game, An Unfinished Life, The Clearing, Lions for Lambs, The Company You Keep. Anything about those movies, any of those movies stand? I kind of put them all together because I think they're just kind of a run of things where he, I think, gets into some financial trouble in his real life, and so he's having to make some movies here. What are your thoughts on these films, Steve? Any of them stand out to you? Any performances you recommend from these films?
Well, The Horse Whisperer, I mean, we haven't talked much about him as a director yet.
And yeah, we'll move into that.
So, I mean, obviously, The Horse Whisperer gives us Scarlett Johansson, you know, that's where she comes from. I think some of these are fun. Spy Game is fun. The Last Castle is an okay movie. You know, there's some good things. I also should say, which I don't know if I've ever mentioned, have I ever told you that I have written for Robert Redford?
Whoa, no, please regale us with this story.
When I was working for the Cousteaus doing one of their underwater documentaries, and I was one of the editors, and Robert Redford was the narrator, and I had written a whole bunch of because when I'm editing, I'm doing the narration and writing narration for myself, and they end up using basically all of the narration I had written. So Robert Redford, when he's narrating America's underwater treasures, is actually saying words that I wrote.
Yeah. That's awesome. That's amazing. So
that's right around this time too.
Wow, that's a great thing to have on your resume. That's amazing. Yeah, I know Spy Game is one I haven't seen, but I know a lot of people like Spy Game. I tried watching about 30 minutes of The Last Castle last night. That ain't my jam. It's a young Mark Ruffalo. And it just doesn't. And Unfinished Life, I know some people like Unfinished Life, but I barely made it through that movie. I didn't think it was that strong. Lions for Lambs is one of those where they go too far left and you're just like, okay, there's no ambiguity here. I don't know why you'd make a film like this. The Company You Keep is fine. I thought it's a good instinct to do it, but I didn't think it quite hit the mark. But then we get into All Is Lost, and I think that's where we see a little bit of a mini renaissance before Robert Redford passes on. This is a fantastic film, as I mentioned earlier, where he is essentially caught on a boat because I think one of those shipping containers hits his boat, and he's got to figure out how to survive on the sea before it sinks and he dies. And this is directed by J.C. Chandor, and I think this is a fantastic movie. A lot of people thought he was going to get nominated for this one, and he wasn't. He didn't speak, I think, as I said, 6 words. So what do you remember about this movie, and did you like this movie, Steve?
I didn't see it, John. I'm sorry.
Oh, man.
I know I should have. It's one I meant to, and I have not seen this film.
Yeah. All right. Well, there you go.
Are you kicking me off the cinephiles?
No, not at all. I just look forward to the day you do see it. I hope you do see it in the future because I think it's a good one for you to check out as well. Then from All Is Lost, we move on to, of course, Captain America: Winter Soldier. Steve, I mean, this is an incredible performance he delivers here as Alexander Pierce. And who better to bring on from the 70s than this icon of anti-establishment and political thrillers like Robert Redford to play this head of Hydra, right? I think it's fantastic.
It's great. It's perfect casting. And this is one we also have done on the Cinephiles. I think we decided we're not going to re-release this one as part of the Robert Redford tribute because it's not his movie. But when he's on screen, it is fantastic. And what's really great about watching him play a bad guy is that Robert Redford intelligence and confidence and clarity that makes him such a great performer, makes him a great antagonist.
Right. Yeah. Good point, man. And I'll just and there are other movies, but I'll just highlight one last one. For, we don't want to make this go too. Oh, geez, we're over an hour. We need to get into the directing and other stuff here. But yeah, you look at Old Man of the Gun. If you haven't seen Old Man of the Gun, I think this is his final last performance. And again, evoking the greatness of his 1970s performance. You can absolutely see elements of Butch Cassidy and Sundance Kid, or even The Sting in this movie. And it is great to see both Sissy Spacek and Robert Redford, these iconic 70s actors, deliver two beautiful performances in their golden age. And it's actually it's a very well-directed film from David Lowery. And I think it's one last final goodbye from Robert Redford as an actor without intending it to be that. And if you enjoyed him in the 70s, this is the best thing that evokes that time in his work from that time for you to enjoy. Have you seen this one yet, Steve?
I'm sorry, John. I get two in a row. I hope that we don't get a third strike on this episode. It's going to be terrible.
I hope not either, man. But I highly recommend them, dude. But you can watch these two back-to-back, All Is Lost and Old Man of the Gun, and enjoy an afternoon of Robert Redford for sure. But let's get into his directing, Steve. And I know we're getting close to wrapping up this tribute because I know we have limited time together on this. But what are your thoughts about his work as a director? You being a director yourself, what do you love about his work in things like Ordinary People, Milagro, Beanfield, War, The River Runs Through It, Quiz Show, which we spoke about, Horse Whisperer, which you mentioned, Legend of Bagger Vance, Lions for Lambs, The Conspirator, The Company You Keep, and his Cathedrals of Culture, which is the last thing he did in 2014. Your thoughts about him as a director and his work as a director?
So Redford's doesn't go on the Mount Rushmore list of directors. He doesn't go on the list of top 10 great directors. He's a really good director. And I think in particular, Ordinary People is a true masterpiece. And it's really the emotional honesty and the power and the sensitivity and the willing to explore difficult areas that's really, really unique. I think Quiz Show is probably his best crafted movie. I mean, it's complicated. There's a lot of threads to keep straight. It's a period piece, and I think he absolutely nails it. And then I think it's kind of like, I like Milagro Beanfield War. It's an interesting film. Legend of Bagger Vance, again, we were just talking about when we just talked about Green Mile, but here we have another magical Negro figure. Trope. I mean, it's right there. Yeah. I mean, it's okay. Like, you know, like these are there. He's a good director. He knows how to do it. But I don't think he goes on the list of great directors.
Yeah, I agree. I think he was called to do Ordinary People, and he was called to do Quiz Show at those times in 1980 and 1994. I think A River Runs Through It. I mean, that and Legends of the Fall, to me, I put them both together in the same pile of like good efforts, but not great movies. And I know some of you may enjoy those films, and I totally respect that. But like for me, they're good efforts, but they're not great movies. I agree with you with Milagro. I mean, that's one as a Latino in 1988. I was like excited for that film, and it didn't quite 100% get there. But, it's not unwatchable. It's certainly a decent film. It's not what you hoped it would be. For The Horse Whisperer, I think it's a little too, how can I say this? It's a little too soft filtery as a movie. Yeah. It's just a little too romantic, and you would hope that the guy who was in The Natural would take that approach to something like The Horse Whisperer. It felt a little too like The Rainmaker from Coppola. Like, I get what you're doing, but I don't see the artistry here as strongly as I would like to see. But you're right. There's Scarlett Johansson. That is the film that put her on the map. And, of course, this is Kristin Scott Thomas just right after, I think a couple of years right after English Patient. So makes sense to put her in the movie. And they have nice chemistry, all three of them. I just don't know if that was a good interpretation of that novel. But I agree with you, then it's really not that great going forward with the rest of his movies. So let's wrap up by talking about his activism, Steve. Like when you see, and we mentioned it earlier in our conversation, but when you see him supporting so many causes here, certainly an LGBTQ plus advocate as well, but environmentalism, Native American rights, and of course the Sundance Film Institute and what he did in promoting independent film. What are your thoughts on his legacy on that end of things?
Well, I mean, obviously my politics and Robert Redford's politics align pretty well. And so I'm proud of and support all the causes that he went after. But I think when you think about influence, there's all of the causes he supports, and then there's Sundance.
Yeah,
and
right.
It is, you know, like, I think there is an argument to be made that while I didn't put him on my Mount Rushmore of directors, he might be among the most important people for the evolution of the art of film of anyone who has existed. I was just looking at, so here are some of the movies that came out of Sundance.
Yep.
Sex, Lies, and Videotape, Reservoir Dogs, Clerks, Little Miss Sunshine, Blair Witch, Napoleon Dynamite, Whiplash, Boyhood, American Psycho, Fruitvale Station, and who are these people? Soderbergh, Tarantino, Paul Thomas Anderson, Richard Linklater, Kevin Smith, Ryan Coogler, Damien Chazelle, Greta Gerwig, all these people came through Sundance, Jordan Peele, Sean Baker. Like the entire art of film was totally transformed by that film festival and its morals and priorities.
Yeah, and it came along again. He has incredible timing in his career as an artist, as a creative, and as a human being. It came along just at the time when independent film was going to explode. And you could argue that either took advantage of that in terms of the timing, or it was a massive reason for independent film becoming a powerful force in the world of films during the 90s and on, and even now. Because, I mean, you look at the documentaries, you mentioned all the theatrical fictional films, but also the documentaries here, American Dream, When We Were Kings, a show that was our second show or first show that we did here on the Cinephiles, Summer of Soul, which is the Quest Love recently, which is an incredible documentary on Hulu, highly recommended, Citizen Four, and Crypt Camp. Those are just some of the documentaries that came out of Sundance. So not only just the actors and directors and writers and producers of fictional film, there's also documentaries that came through, which is something, as I said earlier, was in his heart from the 1970s on, this idea of the power of documentaries. And as you and I are both lovers of documentaries, I think it's an essential thing to mention with his legacy as well. So yeah, I mean, just being, and it still endures, even though I think he sold the stake there, the power, the stake that he has in it. And it's kind of, again, the timing of this, he passes on right before the last Sundance that's going to happen there in Park City, Utah, before it moves, I think, to Colorado. So that is just so interesting to see it going that direction. But yeah, he was also instrumental in the Sundance Channel and other things that connected with the Sundance Institute as well. So again, as we said at the beginning of this tribute, as we're wrapping up, a man who has a legacy, has a very powerful legacy, not only on screen and behind the camera, but also out in the world as an activist, and which is a term he absolutely hated. And they called him the grandfather of independent cinema. And I think that's a great characterization for the power he had, as you said, Steve, earlier, of his effect on the world of film and how he has changed the world of film. And he arguably could be long on the Mount Rushmore of great people who have changed film and kept the medium going and introduced us to an amazing array of voices, diverse voices that we would have maybe never normally gotten a chance to hear and listen to and watch and enjoy.
That to me is his real legacy. I just am thinking, as we've been talking and going back to where we started, which is that even from the beginning of his career, he believed that film could say something.
Yeah.
And he believed in ambiguity, in like not actually giving clear, you know, rigid right and wrong answers, but exploring some of these gray areas. And then you go to Sundance, arguably his life's work. And Sundance is saying, no, this is an art form. Film is an art form that can say something. And in particular, it's an art form that can say something when you find unique voices and voices who's not, haven't been heard before. And so he goes, like, there's gold here. There's gold to be mined with Robert Rodriguez and Quentin Tarantino and with African-American filmmakers and LGBTQ filmmakers and native filmmakers and voices that we haven't heard and international filmmakers. And that it's okay. And this is really, if there's one Sundance aesthetic to me, it's that Sundance is okay with having a movie that you walk out of and go, I don't know how I felt about that. And then you have a discussion. And that's, look at all of Redford's work. I mean, that's really fits into it. And that is a powerful legacy. And in a world where film is frequently trying to tell you exactly how you're supposed to feel when you get to the end of the movie, I think we need some of this Redford-like ambiguity, you know?
Yeah, it's a great point, man. And I'll wrap up our tribute with two quotes from Robert Redford that I think people should think about and have in their lives now because of everything that's going on in our world. And you speak about the ambiguity. This is a quote he gave NPR back in 2013. He said, "All the films I've made are about the country I live in and grew up in. I am not interested in America as black and white or blue or red. I was interested in the gray part where complexity lies." And it feels like we've lost that, Steve, in a lot of ways. Maybe amongst us here who don't, well, I don't want to say that because I do kind of have to deal with how much I live on Twitter. But for a majority of people who don't live on Twitter, the complexity is still there. The conversations are still there. He's a guy that supported Republican candidates, Democratic candidates. He was, you know, it's always what was right for what he felt, who he felt was right for the time and the situation, you know, and he received tributes from political people all up and down the spectrum, from Republican to Democrat to independent, and from numerous artists who also have strong political views in all the different areas there that exist. And I think that's powerful as well. And when talking about his movies and his life, he said, "There have been so many hits on our family," and talking about the trials and tribulations of his family, with which I'm not going to get into because that's stuff you can explore for yourself. He said, "That no one knows about, and I don't want them to, for my family's sake. I've made some interesting movies and I've been very satisfied with the work. But if someone wrapped it all up and said to me, 'What's your greatest achievement?' I'd say my children. They're the best thing in my life." And so I think that's an incredibly powerful thing to end on, to understand, because as great as he was as an artist, he understood what was important in life. And I think that's a window into Robert Redford as a human being, you know?
Absolutely. No, I think that's, it was the very first thing I said, is this is a man who had values, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. Stephen, you as a father, I'm sure can absolutely grasp that and understand that. Well, thank you all so much for joining us for this tribute. Thank you to the Cinephiles fans who are listening to this, because we are going to put this up on the Cinephiles feed as well. In lieu of us doing an episode, we're going to do an episode next week. We're going to start 40-Year-Old Virgin next week. But as Steve said earlier, we are going to re-release all of the films we've done except for Captain America Winter Soldier with new intros, where we discuss these films a little bit more. And so if you're interested in the Cinephiles, you can download that and subscribe to it wherever you download podcasts. Just look for the Cine-Files. We've been doing that show for almost 10 years now. We average anywhere from 150 to 250,000 downloads a month because people enjoy our show so much. And there's no doubt, I have no doubt, if you've never tried it, that you can look through our list of movies and find an episode that covers a film that you love, and we will do it justice. So we encourage you to do that. Steve, any final words, and where can people find you and everything you got going on?
No, but I'm thrilled if people want to check out the Cinephiles. My guess is there's some movie you've always wanted to know more about, and it's on our list. I'm pretty, now that we've been doing this long, I am confident that at least a few of your favorite movies are there. So I'd love you to come check all that out. You can find me at SR Morris on Twitter, SR Morris 1 on Instagram. And that's it. I just like tuning into the truth here.
Thank you, Steve. This is our truth on Robert Redford. And please let us know what you thought about everything we talked about here. His work on screen, his work behind the camera, his activist work, just his legacy overall in the world of film and in the world of life and the Sundance Film Institute. Let us know. Maybe some of you are watching who went to Sundance or been to Sundance Film. I've never been. Let us know what your experience was like. Did any of you move Robert Redford? Go ahead. Yes, Steve.
We have been to Sundance.
Oh.
This Operation Siren went to Sundance that you acted in 2003.
Yeah, sure. I was in a show, but I was never physically there. And I've always wanted to go, but you know, film festivals at my age now kind of give me a little bit of the heebie-jeebies, but I need to get over that just to go see experience festival for the first time. But yeah, it's an incredible thing. So let us know what you thought about it. And if you had any experiences with Robert Redford, because a lot of people were posting their experiences with him. Our friend Saria Blue talked about her first role. One of her first roles was working on a Robert Redford film. I think it was Lions for Lambs. And she talked about how well he treated her on the set. So if you have any stories, let us know down in the comment section below, or let us know on the Cinephiles as well. All right. Thank you so much. Take care of yourselves. Be well. Subscribe to the channel down below. Hit that bell button. Follow me at The Roca Says on all social medias. And we'll talk to you next time with a brand new episode of The Truth. Take care of yourselves, and rest in peace, Robert Redford. Our best to his family and everyone connected to him who loved him. Take care, everybody.
Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $200 into something bigger when you bet on Moneyline, Spread, Totals, Player Props.
$200 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. Fee and fees apply. In-app only.
Your check, your cooperative. As a farmer-owned lender, Farm Credit Mid-America shares the success of the cooperative with our customers, which is why we've returned more than $1.5 billion back to our customer owners over the last 9 years. It's proof being a part of our cooperative pays. Patronage is an annual decision made by the board of directors to return earnings to eligible customers. To learn more about patronage and eligibility, visit fcma.com/patronage.